Welcome to the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 45, recorded December 15th, 2013. Barcodes. I didn't write much recently and podcasted even less. And the reason for this was I was really, really busy. Some people on Twitter, though, told me that they are kind of missing me, which is really sweet. And so I figured, well, I should be doing much more podcasting, or a little more podcasting at least. And when you're really busy like I was, you have to force yourself not to do any work on the weekends. And I'm doing that by, well, basically forcing myself to play games all the time, because otherwise I would be stuck at the computer and typing all the time, and my fingers wouldn't get any rest, and also my brain wouldn't get any rest. So I fear that I would lend myself to a burnout syndrome, or maybe repetitive stress injury on my fingers. So, you know, it sounds weird, but I'm not the youngest. Yeah, I will be turning 40 years next year. And so I figure I need to get my life and my leisure in balance. And that means have five proper working days every week, and then take 2 days off and basically refresh my brain, refresh my fingers. And so, yeah, I was kind of hoping to get a PS4 this Christmas, but unfortunately I didn't pre-order it, so the earliest I can get it seems to be February 2014. I do have a PS3, and I have some games that I haven't finished yet. So what I'm doing, well, I'm just playing all of these and seeing them through to the end. So yesterday I reinstalled Skyrim. I had come to level 49 there, but then I ran out of space on my PS3, and so I had to remove it. But I kept the save game, and eventually I got a larger hard disk, and haven't installed Skyrim until now. So I did that and started to resumed my game there, and I want to finish the main storyline before the end of the year. But you can't be playing all the time, especially if the weather is so nice outside, because it's really not something that I like to do, totally unproductive. So I figured it's a perfect day to actually record a podcasting episode. And it will take me like 1 or 2 hours out of the entire day. And that again lets me, when I get back to playing Skyrim, I will do so with a feeling of accomplishment, because I created something, but at the same time, I didn't type anything. I didn't write a blog entry, or I didn't, as I did sometimes in the past would do, typed show notes or a script for the podcast. But I made some handwritten notes. Yeah, you can, if you listen to this, these are like 10 pages where I put down what I wanted to talk about today. And so, yeah, no typing, no coding, no writing articles or even working on anything else that I'm working on, but just entirely using my brain and using my voice. And the other interesting thing is to check actually if I can still record podcasts. I do have GarageBand. Apparently, I haven't updated it yet to the new version, so I can still record and make an MP3 file out of that. Good. I was lucky there, because I heard the latest version of GarageBand doesn't even let you output MP3s anymore. And you don't have a dedicated podcasting facility there either. So you can only pretend to be a singer, and then instead of singing, you just talk. All right, so let's get to what I wanted to write about. The title of this podcasting episode is Barcodes, for a very simple reason. When I was at WWDC 2013, that was something they announced at the side. So as something like, yeah, and there is the facility to scan barcodes also now in iOS 7. And at that point, I kind of got the seed of an idea in my brain. Apple always referred to barcodes as machine-readable codes, which is technically a perfectly correct term, but nobody outside of Apple seems to use this. So generally, people refer to barcodes as barcodes. Even 2D barcodes, which in itself don't have any bars, but rather small blocks. But one could argue that this small squares are actually not very high, but very wide bars. So, yeah, these are 2D barcodes, and the UPCs you have on products are 1D barcodes. So nobody has ever suggested any better term that became widely used. So we'll stick with this as well, barcodes for everything. And I did a bit of research. I will tell you in a few minutes why. But barcodes are an extremely mature technology. The UPC barcode, as you have them on almost all products that you buy in stores, was announced in 1973 and rolled out officially in 1974. The first item that was, air quotes, officially scanned was a pack of Wrigley's chewing gum. And that was only very shortly before my birthday. So that was this scanning of the chewing gum was June 1974. And I was born July 24th, 1974. So that means barcode scanning, or rather the technology of representing content as bars that can be optically recognized by a machine is 40 years of age, you can say, roughly. So depending on whether you take the announcement date or the, air quotes, release date, it's either this year 2013 that it was 30 years of age, or in 2014, as of June, it will be 40 years in real use. And that means many smart people have thought about how to improve the scanning technology and how to make it more reliable. And there's some creativity going on with barcodes. They originally had to have a certain form and certain white space around them, and everything be standardized. But nowadays, you often see, for example, there's a beer from a brewery in Salzburg called Stiegel, and they have the barcode. Stiegel in English means basically stairs. So they have the barcode looking like several stairs. And that still works, because for a 1D barcode, all you need is a minimum height of the bars where a laser bar could cross all the bars so that it can scan it. So you can be quite creative how to include these barcodes on product packaging. And so all in all, 1D barcodes are 40 years of age, 2D barcodes are slightly younger, but still all in all, this technology of representing something on paper in a way that the machine can recognize it is very old. Now, nowadays you often hear, yeah, barcodes are dead. That will all be done with RFID and NFC in the near future. But what these people forget is that there are some severe drawbacks in having a technology that needs some circuitry on the product side, essentially. You have to have some small chips, and chips will always cost something if you have to manufacture them. Even if they are just a few cents, if you have to stick them on all products, it will still be cost prohibitive, and that's the reason why it wasn't done so far. When you see RFID chips, mostly you see them in luxury items. So something where the $1 or 10 cents or whatever such a RFID chip costs doesn't really have an impact on the price. Whereas on everyday groceries, I don't see RFID tags coming there anytime soon. And then another big drawback of such active technologies is you have the fear of people that they would radiate out some information about their shopping or their activities that they don't want to be publicly known or generally known. So if you have a bag full of items with a RFID tag, somebody who stands close to you can scan these and would know what you have in the bag, versus with barcodes, you scan them, and once the barcode is no longer visible because the whole thing is in a paper bag, nobody can know what you have in the bag. So, well, depending on what shop it is where you bought these things, you might not want somebody to know what's in there. And so I put that down as a big drawback of NFC. Conversely, barcodes, as they are printed on product packaging, products will always have a certain size, and barcodes can be made to be really small and integrate themselves really nicely into this product packaging. So putting a barcode on a label is something that essentially comes for free. Yeah? You just have to print some lines next to the rest of the text of the thing. And that's something that's commonly done because, as I said, nothing beats free. So it's, in summary, barcodes are a free technology to put on product packaging. They don't require any sophisticated technology anymore. They can be scanned with laser scanners for 40 years now, and with CCDs, as they are in a smartphone camera, basically for, I'd say, 10 years. How long do we have smartphones with cameras? So even this technology is well understood and well established. And the only missing piece there is, as a supermarket, for example, you have a product database. You have the information. If at the cash register somebody scans a certain code, this is item with a certain name with a certain price, so that it can be put on the receipt. And that's an advantage a supermarket has that we end consumers don't. Yeah? So we don't have access to this point of sale database that the company has. And I felt, so that was one of the thoughts I had back in last summer, this is an unfair situation. Yeah? I am able to scan things now, technically, with barcode scanning being part of iOS 7, and most iOS devices are now being on iOS 7. So last I heard, it was like 74% already on iOS 7. That means every user of an iOS device potentially can scan barcodes, but not every user has access to such product information databases. So there's something to be done about that, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. So if you are a small app developer or hobbyist app developer, and you might have some apps on the App Store, as I see it, there are two ways how you can make a successful apps. So either your app has some intrinsic value because it's, say, it's a game. Yeah, the game has the value of being fun while you play it. Or it's a productivity app. Yeah, some sort of list or calendar or whatever. Or it performs some calculations on the computer that is your smartphone. So there's some value that you derive from just having the abilities of this app in your pocket. Or the second possibility is that there's some sort of access to content through this app. So that could be video on demand, to watch videos, video content, or some music player, or even the tweets of the people you follow. This is socially generated content that through the Twitter app you get access to. Or to give another example, eBay. eBay has a massive database of content with all these auctions going on, and the eBay app allows you to access this content and search it. So either your app has some intrinsic value where it doesn't necessarily need something from the network, or it accesses some data, information, content that's on the web and pulls it down via network requests, and you get to consume this. So what do you do as a small app developer? Yeah, do you either have an idea that provides a really great value, but often here it's quite expensive to research that if you want to put in some fancy algorithm that your app calculates some values that would take very long time to calculate if you did it by hand? Well, that's research you need for that. Or you have to put some work into the programming of such value. The other possibility for you as a small app developer would be that you are lucky to have access to some sort of a big corporation's content. Yeah, either you are contracted to build such an app for a corporation, or you talk to such a corporation and license access to this content. So these are the two possibilities I'm seeing here. And something that's sort of missing in between here is to have this intrinsic value being very affordable and have content, in this case related to physical products, available to you as a web service. And I've got something to say about that in a short while. So I just wanted to drive home the fact that on iOS devices you have always on internet, more or less. Thank you, Apple, for making that the default, so to speak. So if you now have the ability to scan physical items, and if there was a way to retrieve information on these physical items over the internet, that would be really valuable. And this realization started me to be really excited last summer, and it was more or less the seed for a book and a web-based service. But before I talk about that, one thing I figured I needed to do before I can really wholeheartedly dive into these two things was I needed to work a bit on my focus. Over the years, I've put several apps on the App Store. Some made a little bit of money, but for the most part, it's now really a very, very long tail. Yeah, so a couple of dollars here and there. Somebody always finds my apps and sees them worthy of paying money for them, but it's no longer the case that I could even consider being able to live from these payments. or even fund further development on these apps. And one of the apps that is making the lion's share of our app income is Linguan. Linguan being a fancy strings file editor that also helps you find missing translations. So if you have a new language in your app, it will tell you if you have all the tokens localized for this new language, and some other fancy things like you have a built-in scanner so it can scan for new tokens in your source files. And Linguan is about makes about $500 per month at the moment. So I figured, there's the problem with $500 a month, you cannot fund any improvements and ongoing development. And then another problem that Linguan has is at the moment, the current version on the App Store cannot be sandboxed because of two reasons. One, it uses the Xcode proj file to find the source code and the strings files. And the other, that it basically remote controls IBTool. Now, one thing that would need to be done in order to make any new improvements and additions to Linguan is to get sandboxing enabled, because otherwise Apple doesn't allow us to add anything besides doing bug fixes. There's ways how you can get around that. IBTool, strictly speaking, is no longer necessary. So if you did a Linguan 2, you could read the XML based zip files, which are there's a new format since the latest Xcode version that is XML based, as opposed to key value binary files for zip files. So you could probably rather easily replace this functionality with some internal functionality, like I did replace gen strings. Linguan already is using an open source component of mine to scan the strings files and get new tokens. And something like this you could also do for the XML-based zip files. And the other thing is, for the sandboxing to work with Linguan, you would have to allow the user to more or less open the entire project folder once. Yeah, so you would have to have a dialogue in order to access the files of your project. Could you please open the project folder? And this concept is called the power box. So if you have a file dialogue and the user selects the proper folder, this file dialogue will give you access to everything in this folder. And what you can then do is keep track of this access, or hold on to it rather, by means of a scope bookmark. So you get sort of an encrypted data file that you can save somewhere, and if you have this, then the system knows you are authorized to access all the files of this project. And if you manage to have a nice interface for that, then I don't think users would have anything against that, having to do that one time. And the big advantage there would be then finally Linguan is able to be sandboxed, and you can start adding new fancy features. That's not saying that there's really, really much to do, because Linguan is working really fine like it is at the moment. But any kind of software benefits from having a major release every year or so. And what would probably be a good way ahead with Linguan is that if somebody were to acquire it from us, to more or less take on Linguan 1 sales as a monthly income there is at the moment, maybe do a couple of small bug fixes, but then get to work on a version 2. And this version 2, probably you would want to put this on the Mac App Store as a new SKU. So the people who are using it and are supporting it, and at the moment there are around 10,000 users of Lingyuan, which I can tell from the update reports. So 10,000 people have it installed. I'm pretty sure that a good portion of these people still likes and loves Lingyuan. And if there was somebody making a really professional, new, high grade, high quality version 2, they would have no problem paying, say, $20 or $30 for that, because the value that Lingyuan provides is unique and is really, really powerful. So what we did, and I keep repeating we, because Lingyuan, I never programmed Lingyuan myself. It was created by partners of mine. Their name is Byte Poets. And they were always doing the development, and I was sort of doing the marketing. Unfortunately, yeah, did not do a good job because I'm not a marketeer. I'm just promoting it every now and then and talking about it on my website and podcasts. But what basically they told me is they want to sell Lingyuan for no less than 10,000 euros. So 5,000 for them, 5,000 for me, because we have an agreement to share 50-50. And the initial announcement of that got four to five interesting parties, of which two had some weird suggestions, like one was that we kept the app and the other guy would just kind of develop on it. Another suggestion was to pay lower amounts and do several installments, like two or three installments, and all depend on, only pay from actual profits. Yeah, but the problem is we want to have a clear cut, and we want to have the resources being still back available for us. So if somebody is acquiring it, Lingyuan, from us, then we want to have sort of a transition period, but there should be a time from which on we can say, okay, now Lingyuan is owned by company X. And so any kind of installments or partnership or anything just doesn't fly for us. We did discuss this quite a bit, because 10,000 euros sounded a bit high to most people. So we dropped that to 7,500 euros, which is about 2 years of sales. So generally speaking, you can assume that apps can sell for 2 to 3 years of annual sales. So we're going with 2 years. This is the lower limit where my partners would accept to sell it. If we cannot find somebody, they told me they would rather open source it, because at anything less than their share, and it would be 3,750 euros if we split this, they are a company of, I think, 20 or 30 employees. So if it's below this limit, they said, with the taxes they have to pay on it, and I didn't quite understand it, but their last word on that so far is, if their share is below 3,750, they want to open source it and wouldn't bother with trying to transition it to somebody. And with this lower offer, I got two no's. One offered first 6,000, and then he improved to 6,500, which is still below our reserve of 7,500. And one said, asked if we could delay the decision until mid of January. So since there is no offer on the table that meets our minimum requirement, if I wait for one more month, to make a decision that doesn't hurt. So we are probably going to do that. There are three scenarios that are possible with Lingyuan. Either somebody offers 7,500 cash and gets all the benefits. Yeah, gets the name, gets the icon, gets the source code, gets the expertise, anything that I can provide to make it a smoother transition. There's a domain name, lingyuanapp.com, which is part of the deal. And of course, I would transfer the app to the new owner's iTunes account. So there would be no interruption in sales. You would still get your $400 to $500 every month from that, right from the start. So I don't see that being much of a risk. I rather see there's a really great opportunity if there's a company that is willing to take this on, invest a little bit, say, as I said, a few bug fixes, and then start to work on a version 2 and sell the version 2 at a price point where you make back your initial investment. Then that should be you should be able to achieve that within, say, a year. Yeah. Or the other third, and not by far any favorite option, would be to open source it, because yeah, it's a great tool, and it would be a shame if it were lost. But as I said, if I were by myself, I would probably have taken the 6,500. But since I'm just partners with these guys, and they have set their mind on something, there's nothing I can do than hope that somebody would actually see the value in there. So back to barcodes. I mentioned there's an idea for a book and an idea for a service that was brewing in my head since the summer. So as it so happens, I got contacted by a publisher in the fall. So I think it was September or so. The publisher told me they wanted to increase the number of iOS-related books in their catalog, and they were looking specifically for half-size books. And so half-size meaning a full-size book is typically 400 to 600 pages, and a half-size book would be 200 to 300 pages. And have something that's sort of specialized on iOS. So at that time, I had like three ideas for books in my brain. It's always been kind of a dream of mine to be able to write a book and have a book published in my name. And so one idea was something about barcodes. The second was something about making Mac apps for iOS developers. And the third, I cannot really remember. But then the publisher, or rather the acquisitions editor who contacted me, asked me which do I feel the most passionate about. And to this, I honestly said, well, barcodes, because I think it's an amazing scenario that we have this year and next year. So what I did is I made a proposal with a table of content that got reviewed by 10 people outside of the publisher's company, people that follow me on Twitter even, some. And the feedback people gave generally was very, very favorable. I had to do two more iterations of the table of contents. The first iteration, I took out all the terms like AV Foundation, AirPlay, and so on, because my acquisitions editor told me, take these out, they are too complicated, nobody knows what this is about. And then the second iteration of the table of content, he told me, well, I should put them back in so that people, if they skim through the table of contents, they see all these Apple technologies in there. And that might be a reason for buying the book. So I did that. And in the end, ended up with a book contract, which essentially made me a signed author. Yeah, not yet a published author. For that, I need to finish the book first. But hey, that's a big step there. And the interesting thing is, for me, I'm not adverse to writing about iOS topics. I've been doing that for a couple of years now. So for the most part, writing is writing, and basically creating sample apps is something that I know how to do quickly. But there are some things that are very interesting for me to learn about how it is different to write for a big book as opposed to a blog post. There are some concepts that are quite different. You don't want to just sum up blog posts that you have published into a book, because what reason would there be to buy that? Because you get everything, and even better, find it more quickly via Google or a blog search facility. If you put something in a book, it should be, different. It should be giving you a value that you cannot have otherwise. And I like to believe we are really onto something here. So I'm not just writing a tutorial on barcode scanning in iOS 7, but what I'm actually doing, I like to call it a vertical book. Yeah, so not vertical as in sitting in the bookshelf, but vertical as in cutting through multiple horizontal layers of various Apple technologies. Because barcode scanning, there are many aspects to that and related technologies. And what I want to write is about all these related technologies. So I'll talk about that in a second. But who am I writing this book for? I think I identified three groups of people for this book. First group would be somebody working for a large company that wants to reap the benefits from leveraging barcodes for increasing internal efficiencies. Think of a enterprise. Everybody's got an iPhone nowadays, and what they could have is an enterprise app where they can scan some products they have on shelves, doing inventory solutions or some sort of point of sale thing. The second group would be iOS developers who had no good reason to dive into those new iOS 7 technologies, but are intrigued by them. And barcode scanning here would serve as the common thread, sort of the reason to look at technologies like scanning, display and printing, user location, context, networking, OAuth, background fetching, and even passkit. All of these have some sort of tie-in with barcode scanning. And this book would sort of, the narrative that goes through everything would be bringing together the physical and the digital world. And barcode scanning itself would just be one of six chapters. So that's the second group of people I'm writing this for. And the third group would be iOS developers who might have a few not so successful apps on the App Store and who are looking for kind of what's the next great thing they can build. And I believe that this nexus of barcodes and a set of iOS 7 technologies, that it's new, coming together enables a new fascinating kind of apps that hasn't been possible before. And these are the three groups that I'm writing for with a certain minimum level, because I don't want to do a beginner book. I want to have at least a certain skill level. My publisher calls it the minimally qualified reader. So basically, I define it, I want to write a book for somebody who has a basic working knowledge of iOS app making. So you should know how to start a new project. If I tell you to create an empty project from the template, you should know how to do that. I don't want to walk you through that. I don't want to have to explain instance variables, for example, or properties. Yeah, those things you should know. If you have these basics down, then I think this book can be really, really interesting to you if you're one of the three groups of people that I talked about. So what's the status there? So far, I got around 1.5 chapters of a total of 6. And I think I'll have the second chapter finished by the end of December. And the great thing with this publisher that I'm with is as I have 3 chapters done, it will go to external review. And also they have a system where you can basically pre-order the book. And if you do that, you get access to what has already been written. So it's sort of you get the raw text of the chapters, yeah, all nicely formatted and with graphics and everything, but raw, yeah. And you can already reap the benefit from this knowledge. And that will probably be the case at the end of January, I guess. So really, really something awesome going on here, working on my first book. And the second big topic related to barcodes I mentioned earlier is I want to do a service, a web-based service. Seeing myself as a small developer as well, I figured if there was a service that allowed me to get product information, really, really basic things like just the name and maybe a picture of a product, maybe a category, some really, really basic things, if I could get them over a nicely designed web-based API, then that would really be enabling for many, many developers to do fancy and really useful apps without having to have the content themselves and without having to think of some amazing other value proposition. So let me give you a couple of examples what I think you could do with such an API. We are frequently buying conserved food or kind of food that has an expiration date, say, in a couple of months. We buy 2 instead of just 1 because we figure, yeah, we like this product and we're going to be using it down the road eventually, or maybe we got a better price because we bought 2. But the problem is they are sitting on a shelf and you don't know how much of an expiration is left in them, in these products. So I'm figuring one kind of app that I would like to see using this API that I'm mentioning would be something where, say, once a year or once per quarter, I go through my stock of food, yeah, all those cans and all this packs. I would scan each of these, the ones that have an expiration date on them. I would use like a date picker to specify, and then this app would show me on a calendar what expires when, and maybe send me a local push notification a week before something expires so that I can use it. Because otherwise, we often have the situation that, say, once every spring, we throw away lots of food that expired half a year ago. Yeah. So if something is like overdue, over the expiration date by a month or so, it's probably not a problem. But we regularly throw away things that have expired a year ago. Yeah. So I don't want that to happen anymore. Especially since all of these things cost money and there's people starving in the third world. So that's a conscience thing. Yeah, I want to be able to scan the things. Now, where's the value of such an API, product API? Well, I don't want to have to specify the name of each of these products myself. So if I have a standalone app, where I scan, then maybe take a picture, maybe add the title of the product and then the expiration date. That's very much work that only I benefit from. But if there is an API that also lets me push these informations like the picture and the title up to the cloud, then somebody else scanning the same product would already get a picture and the title. And if he doesn't like the picture, okay, he can make one himself. But it basically, the first person scanning a thing reduces the work for everybody else using it. And then that's not just for this one app that I just described, but there might be other apps and other scenarios where the same product would be scanned in a totally different context. Say the context could be a shopping app. Yeah, you scan things that the app in your say your wife's pocket gets a list of things she should buy as well. Yeah, it doesn't have to do anything with expiration date tracking, but still this information, a specific product, please get that for me. And I don't have to create a name for it, create an image for it or anything. So that's the idea, that all the people using this API would be sharing the same product information. Let me give you two other examples that I thought of. One could be if I'm asking in my social network, where can I get a PS4? Yeah. Well, right now, the only way I could know where to get one would be to go online, look at Geizhals.at or look at Amazon.de. But if I could sort of broadcast this out to people who know me, and if then somebody sees a PS4 in a specific set, yeah, at say MediaMarkt, he could scan it and could tell me, yeah, I'm seeing this here, they want 400 euros for it, and this is the location where I saw it. So I could have an app scenario where I could use my social circle as sort of finders for specific things that I need, or to recommend to me specific products for a general question. Yeah, it wouldn't have to be like tell me where I can find a specific instance, but I would just say, where can I get any PS4? And then somebody would say, right, the version with the camera and this game I saw here for that many euros, and another version, which is another product code, I would see somewhere else. And so this information would be available via this API to any kind of app you want to base on that. And the third and final idea that I had in this case is, I think I have almost all iOS devices there have ever been. And I just recently got myself the iPad Air and the iPhone 5S. I'm still missing the 5C and the Retina Mini, but I'll get those eventually as well. But every time you get a new Apple device, it's got a UPC. So that sort of gives you the model of the device. And all Apple devices have a serial number. And the serial number is also a barcode on the box. So what you could do is you could make an app that allows me to keep track of my Apple devices. So if I get a new device, I scan it to get the model. Then I scan it to have the serial number in my app. And via the serial number, you can do a lookup on Apple's website to see how long the warranty will go. Yeah, and you don't even have to do it in a way to scrape or anything, but if you just open the self-serve Apple.com page with the serial number that you have in there, you see right away, do I have still warranty and so on. And then you could, from this page, for example, take the purchase date or the expiration date, whether or not you have AppleCare, when is the latest time that you have to get AppleCare for this device. These are things that this app could manage for me. So I don't have like a big heap of things. I don't know the serial numbers of. I don't know who is using them. And currently I have a numbers list of all the people in my company who has got which device in use. And that's something this app could do for me as well. So I could say, okay, the iPhone 5 and the iPad 3, that's now, or actually the iPad 4, is now in use by my colleague Stefan. And if he returns it because he gets a new one next year, when I get the iPhone 6, he gets my 5S. So that's something this app could do for me. And again, because I'm scanning a UPC that's on the box, the first time somebody scans that, he will probably make a quick picture and he will state, okay, that's the iPhone 5S, 64 gigabytes in gold. Yeah. The next person adding this to his app keeping track of Apple devices doesn't have to add it anymore. So that's the value proposition of this service here. At least the value proposition for app developers, because I want this to be a platform that enables this new kind of product-centric apps that I was talking about. And also, I've got sort of a working title for it. Somebody suggested to me, and we really loved that, so we took it on, to call it Product Layer. So if you hear me talking about Product Layer, this is what I'm talking about, an API that you can use to make fabulous new apps. So status of this, I'm working on this with two friends of mine. It's a bit pre-alpha, so we have some the basics going on. We have a database, we have an API. I have an SDK that wraps these API calls, but it's not yet in a stage that I can share with somebody because it's still too unstable. So you wouldn't have any fun with that because it's not installed on a production server. But once we get to a stage where we can say, okay, it's now a alpha, yeah, the API doesn't change all the time and it's on a fixed name, yeah, like api.productlayer.net, yeah, then we're going to do a private beta for that and more on this as it develops. So finally, back to the podcast in general, you are obviously listening. So my question to you is, would you be interested in getting to hear more from you in 2014? If so, please drop me an email, send me a tweet at Coconetics. My email address would be oliver@coconetics.com. I'd love to hear from you, your suggestions, your hopes and suggestions, and to just hear whether or not anything I'm mumbling here is of any interest to anybody. So it would be of great help if you could give me some feedback. So that's it. What's left for me to say is have a Merry Christmas, and if we don't see each other before then, Happy New Year. Have a nice 2014.